You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
When the impulse to exterminate reemerged in Europe under the Nazis, very few people were able to recognize it as a homecoming, mistaking it instead for something wholly new, a kind of alien invasion. Now, this was not some kind of oversight. The failure to recognize these glaring continuities was a choice made by the powerful to protect their own interests. Because to place the Nazi Holocaust inside a lineage of Holocausts would have forced a reckoning with history.
That's Naomi Klein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR's Naomi Klein on Holocausts and Historical Reckoning. Holocaust, derived from the Greek, is a large-scale calamity involving fire. Today, the term is specifically used to describe the German genocide of the Jews. But it has a long history. The European mass murder of indigenous peoples in North and South America killed 55 million, or 90% of the population, between 1492 and 1600. That's a little more than 100 years. More bloodbaths were to follow. In Africa, many millions were killed in the Congo by Belgium. Germany wiped out the Herero and Nama peoples in southwest Africa. In the Middle East, that was quickly followed by the Turkish slaughter of the Armenians. Then came Auschwitz. Since the end of World War II, barbarisms continue. Cambodia, Bosnia, Myanmar. Naomi Klein says, "The Nazi Holocaust is finally being placed in history, connected to the terrors that came before and after." Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She teaches at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her articles appear in leading publications around the world. She's the award-winning author of many books. Her latest is Doppelganger. She spoke at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, in mid-April 2024. And now, Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning.
Many colleges and universities have not shown the level of courage that you have here at Swarthmore. I've lost track of how many events have been canceled, how many student groups have been banned, how many protests have been repressed, how many chants have been twisted to mean their opposite. These bans, these unsayables, this is part of what we might think of as the word front of the war. And though it does not bear comparison with the sniper and cluster bomb front of the war, it has nonetheless been ferocious. Every time we speak on these topics, we feel the charge. And the words that tend to feel most combustible are reliably the ones that draw parallels between Israel's actions and the actions of the Nazis during the Second World War. Words like ghetto, concentration camp, liquidation, fascism, ethnic cleansing, even the word genocide itself. When we speak these words, we know we have to watch out. This war over words began very early. As soon as Israeli politicians responded to Hamas's horrific attacks on October 7th, by openly stating that they held 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza responsible, pledging to cut off food and water and rain down indiscriminate hellfire and treat Palestinians as, quote, human animals. And they followed through on many of these threats in myriad concrete ways with the full and enthusiastic backing of governments across the so-called West. In mid-October, Gustavo Petro, president of Colombia, identified this as a prelude to genocide, and he put out a statement that placed Israel's attacks in the context of a global war waged by the rich against the poor, one intensifying in the era of climate breakdown, when migrants are left to die on our increasingly fortress borders. He said, "The barbarism of consumption based on the death of others leads us to an unprecedented rise of fascism, and thus to the death of democracy and freedom. It is barbarism, or global 1933, as I call it. 1933 was the year when Hitler rose to power. What we see in Palestine will also be the suffering of the world, of all peoples of the global South." This, of course, did not go over well, and Petro was condemned by Israel and its Western backers as an anti-Semite, predictably. But that did not prevent other leaders in the global South from saying much the same. In February, Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, who has long had friendly relationships with Israel, had become so alarmed with Israel's seemingly deliberate slaughter and starvation of the trapped Palestinian population in Gaza that he compared it with the Nazi genocide, saying he could think of no other analogy. Most contentious are the actions of the South African government and its decision to charge Israel at the ICJ in The Hague with violating the UN Genocide Convention. What I want to discuss is the reaction and where it fits into this larger war over words. Every time Israel has faced accusations that its actions in Gaza fit the legal definition of genocide or imminent genocide, the response has fit a very clear pattern. We are told that the accusations are inherently anti-Semitic, indeed blood libel against the Jewish people, who cannot possibly be committing genocide because A, Israel defines itself as a state of the Jewish people and was forged out of the flames of the Nazi Holocaust. Ergo, according to this logic, to compare Israelis to Nazis is to blame the victims for attempting to survive. And B, the Jewish state is under perennial threat of another Nazi genocide, as October 7th allegedly proved. Because Hamas are the real genocidal Nazis, not Israelis, according to this story, so anything Israel does is necessarily genocide prevention, not genocide perpetration. We've all heard variations of these circular arguments. They play out on a kind of repetitive loop. I want to zoom in on one example of this. When Lula made his comparison between Gaza and the Nazi Holocaust, Israel responded with a very unconventional piece of diplomatic theater. In addition to declaring Lula persona non grata, Israel's foreign minister summoned Brazil's ambassador for a reprimand. But he chose a very peculiar location for this diplomatic meeting, the Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. A people who suffered a genocide cannot possibly commit one, according to this logic, especially not a state that exists to prevent another Jewish genocide, which inside Israel's national narrative is always just over the horizon. Now, this episode is telling because it displays a complete collapsing of time and space. Israel's actions in Gaza are cast as a response to events that took place 8 decades earlier on another continent. The realities of past genocide atrocities are presented as definitive proof that it is heretical to compare any other crime to then, unless it's another crime committed against Israel, in which case those crimes can be presented as a seamless continuation of the Nazi Holocaust, never mind the difference in centuries, geographies, and the relative power of the players involved. Now, there have been many such clashes over language and historical analogies. Michael Rothberg, a chair of Holocaust studies at UCLA, refers to these skirmishes as comparison controversies. Another notable one was sparked by Masha Gessen. Writing in The New Yorker, Gessen compared Gaza pre-September 7th to a ghetto similar to the ghettos the Nazis used in Eastern Europe to warehouse and incarcerate Jews. And now, Gessen wrote of Gaza, quote, "The ghetto is being liquidated." Predictably, those words provoked apoplectic responses, particularly in Germany, where Gessen was very nearly stripped of the annual Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought, a particular irony given Arendt's commitment to deciphering the origins and foreshadowings of totalitarianism, including fascist totalitarianism. And I think open letters are probably still flying over Jonathan Glazer's speech at the Oscars, during which he dared to warn against the Nazi Holocaust being used as cover for crimes against humanity in Gaza. Now, to be clear, none of the people who I have cited were saying that Israel's crimes in Gaza are a carbon copy of the Nazi Holocaust, the most murderous chapter of the 20th century. Of course, they were not saying that. As Gessen stressed, to compare is not to conflate, not to erase specificity. Gaza is not a factory deliberately designed for mass murder, as the Nazi death camps were. And thankfully, we are not yet close to the scale of the Nazi death toll. But as we've already heard, multiple UN and US human rights experts tell us that millions of Palestinians face starvation now. Moreover, the entire reason that the post-World War II edifice of international humanitarian law was erected, including the ICJ and the Genocide Convention, was so that we would have the tools to collectively identify patterns before history repeats at scale. And some of the patterns, the walls, the ghettos, the mass killing, the repeatedly stated eliminationist intent, the mass starvation, the pillaging, the joyful dehumanization, and the deliberate humiliation are indeed repeating. I agree that we should never make Nazi analogies casually because it risks trivialization, but neither should we be so timid or so proprietary that we turn real-world political tendencies into mystical ones. Now, I wanted to begin with these various comparison controversies because they point to something foundational. Despite appearances, they are not simply battles over hot-button words and languages. They speak to a much deeper battle over what I've come to think of as two competing stories about the birth of the modern world. Two very different sets of ideas about what European fascism and the Nazis represented within these two stories. Were the Nazis an exception in an otherwise uplifting story of spreading progress and civilization to all corners of the globe? Or were their tactics and logics omnipresent in this story, a through line that has been the flip side of the civilizing project from the very start? Beneath these bitter disagreements about who deserves to be seen as a fascist and a Nazi in the here and now are far less explored disagreements about who the Nazis were originally when they came to power in the 1930s. So for simplicity's sake, let's call these two stories Story 1 and Story 2. Now, Story 1 doesn't require much explanation since it is the air we all breathe. It tells us that in the 1930s and 40s, large parts of liberal, democratic, peaceable Europe fell to the twisted and evil force that was fascism. In this story, the Nazis are the mirror opposite of everything for which Western powers stand, uniform to our pluralist, closed to our open, authoritarian to our democratic, cruel to our kind, and so on. In this story, Nazism emerged in Germany out of a unique and explosive combination of factors. The humiliation of the national psyche after Germany's defeat in World War I was compounded by the economic hardships unleashed by the Great Depression, and the two of these forces combined to unleash the hounds of anti-Semitism, according to Story 1, said to be a deep and primordial hatred that exists as an immovable subconscious in all cultures. So according to Story 1, this convergence of forces creates a kind of a rupture in the time-space continuum that was the Holocaust, a specifically anti-Semitic form of mass slaughter that has never been seen before, but which, now that it has been unleashed, could recur at any time, not to anyone, according to this story, but specifically to the Jews. The quote you see is from Sweden's former Prime Minister, Göran Persson, who was also the founder of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA, which many of you may be familiar with from the IHRA definition that defines anti-Semitism as criticizing Israel as a Jewish state. So I use this quote because I think it might be the best capsule summary of what I'm calling story one, aka the story that the West likes to tell itself about the Holocaust. He said, "It happened once, it should not have happened, but it did. It must not happen again, but it could." That is why education about the Holocaust is fundamental. So he said that in 2000. Now, because it could always happen again, the unique and incomprehensible force that it must be battled with its own special weapons, according to this narrative. And the most important of these weapons is not international law. No. Within story one, these are deemed to be too weak. There is only one force that can repel another Jewish genocide, and that is the highly militarized ethnostate of Israel, a fortress land for the Jews with its own army, bankrolled by Germany as a form of reparations for the Holocaust, but also by countries like the US and Canada, which, though they defeated Hitler on the battlefield, did close their borders to the vast majority of Europe's Jews who might have found asylum and been saved. So it's seen as a kind of reparation for governments here in North America, and also, of course, for Germany, which has defined standing with Israel as its Staatsraison, its reason for state. In story one, Israel is the embodiment of never again. So, of course, people who subscribe to it cannot fathom the possibility that Israel is perpetrating an again against another hated people right now. And, of course, story one is very convenient because all of these countries, US, Canada, Germany, the UK, have their own geopolitical and economic reasons for wanting a Western outpost in the middle of the oil and gas-rich Arab world, and how convenient it is to wrap that in the virtue of learning from the sins of the past. So this is a very familiar story to most of us who have received a classic Western education. The Holocaust was not the only crime against humanity that most of us learned about in school, of course. We also, no doubt, heard about the conquistadors, the mass slaughters of indigenous people. We learned about the trade in enslaved African people and Jim Crow and apartheid in South Africa. But these lessons, I assume if your education was anything like mine, were cordoned off from the ways we learned about the Holocaust, which was always in a class of its own, surrounded by a kind of ring of fire, to use a term from Claude Lanzmann, the filmmaker who made the landmark docuseries Shoah, which shaped understandings of the mass killings for generations. Lanzmann said this unique ring of fire was a boundary that you cannot cross because it is impossible to convey a certain absolute horror. Claiming to do so is to be guilty of the gravest transgression. So this is a very important principle to understand about how the Holocaust is imagined. You're not allowed to compare. So we absorbed the lesson that there was something sacrilegious about even speaking about the Nazi Holocaust in the same breath as any other crime, that to do so was to make it less horrific, somehow ordinary or trivial. This was the flip side of the post-World War II cries of never again, an unspoken never before. The Holocaust was a rupture in history, out of space and out of time. As Person said, it happened once. But what if it happened more than once? What if it happened many times, albeit at different speeds and scales? What if Holocausts are a through line? Which brings us to story two. So there has always been another way of understanding the Nazis' exterminatory project, another explanation, which was left out of the dominant histories that I've been invoking. It's a story that has always been told in the global South, in places with firsthand experience with European imperialism, and also in what's sometimes referred to as the South and the North, in Black and Indigenous communities in places like North America. In story two, the Holocaust was not a rupture, nor a new invention. Rather, it was a homecoming of the violent, exterminatory logics and methods that European powers had directed at those deemed savage and devilish since the Spanish Inquisition. logics that began in Europe, but for the past 500 years or so, mostly ravaged lands and bodies outside of Europe's borders, in the colonies. But according to story two, in the 1930s, those logics and methods turned inwards and were unleashed on large segments of the European population, with the subhumans being exterminated no longer Africans or indigenous peoples in the Americas, or not only, but white Europeans, albeit gay, disabled, autistic, Roma, communist, and on an unfathomable scale, Jewish Europeans. Story two does not see Hitler and the Nazis as an aberrant chapter in Western history, one that primarily has to do with the supposedly primordial nature of Jew hatred, though anti-Semitism certainly has deep roots in Europe. Rather, it sees the Nazis as an expression of an exterminatory supremacist logic that has been at the center of the most violent chapters in European history. One of the most important voices in this early debate was W.E.B. Du Bois in The World in Africa, published at the close of the Second World War. He observed that, quote, there was no Nazi atrocity, concentration camps, wholesale maiming and murder, defilement of women, or ghastly blasphemy of childhood, which Christian civilization of Europe had not long been practicing against colored folk in all parts of the world in the name of and for the defense of a superior race born to rule the world. What was new, Du Bois wrote, was that genocide was coming home. This perspective was echoed by the Martinican anti-colonial author and politician Aimé César. In his hugely influential text, Discourse on Colonialism, first published in 1950, he rejected the flattering narrative that Nazism was somehow an alien force that had invaded civilized Europe, one that was valiantly slain by the British and the Americans while being resisted by the French, because they understood the dire threat that fascism posed to humanism. On the contrary, he wrote, Europeans tolerated Nazism before it was inflicted on them. Until these methods returned to European soil, he wrote, they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then, it had been applied only to non-European peoples. Hitler's crime for the Allies, César believed, was that he did to Jews and Slavs what, quote, until then had been reserved exclusively for the non-white colonized in foreign lands. But seen from his perch in the Caribbean, where indigenous peoples had been slaughtered to make way for enslaved Africans, who Europeans forced into brutal labor, it was all one long, continuous, snaking story. Genocide after genocide. So I'll share one more quote, because it is so striking. César, who taught and mentored Frantz Fanon, wrote that in his view, Hitler was not merely the enemy of the United States and the United Kingdom. He was their shadow, the part of themselves they could not bear to see, their twisted doppelganger. As Robin Kelly points out in an introduction to the reissue of César's book, many radical black intellectuals, including C.L.R. James and George Padmore, quote, understood fascism not as some aberration from the march of progress, an unexpected right-wing turn, but a logical development of Western civilization itself. These thinkers, Kelly wrote, viewed fascism as a blood relative of slavery and imperialism, global systems rooted not only in capitalist political economy, but racist ideologies that were already in place at the dawn of modernity. So there is another source that we should turn to for what the Nazis learned from colonialism, and that is the Nazis themselves. Hitler spoke and wrote extensively about the many ways in which he modeled his genocidal regime after various European colonialist rampages, and from the structures of racial hierarchy pioneered inside North America, including on the Western frontier. So I'm going to give a few examples. In 1941, Hitler remarked, concentration camps were not invented in Germany. It is the English who are their inventors, using this institution to gradually break the backs of other nations. Concentration camps had, in fact, been used in many colonial contexts. by the Spanish in Cuba, by the British in what is now South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, with tens of thousands of captives dying in the disease-ridden enclosures. And they were also used by the Germans before the Nazis came to power in Germany's African colonies, just 25 years before the Nazis rose to power. In fact, the event widely understood as the first genocide of the 20th century took place in what is now Namibia, with the mass slaughter of the Nama and Herero or Over Herero people. Germany had decided it needed room to grow, Lebensraum. We often think that this term came from the Nazi Holocaust, but it actually came from Africa. The colonists had set up various farms and settlements in Southwest Africa. They'd also heard there were diamonds, and they were interested in those. And they pushed the Nama and Herero people off of their lands and into the deserts. And eventually, the situation grew so desperate, waged a war, which included killing many German settlers. The Germans responded with a genocidal fury. Those who survived the bullets were corralled into newly built concentration camps and forced into labor. The most deadly of these camps was in a place called Shark Island. By the time the camps were closed in 1908, 80% of the Herero had been exterminated, and roughly 50% of the Nama people. On Shark Island, each prisoner was carefully assigned a number, which was a prototype for the careful accounting in Nazi camps. And there were other lines of connection. Doctors and other scientists from Germany traveled to the camps to conduct medical experiments on the Nama and Herero, mostly involving measuring their skulls. They were, in fact, obsessed with skulls and sent hundreds of them back to be studied and displayed in German educational and cultural institutions. So with these measurements, the Germans were trying to prove, of course, that African skulls were smaller, which they were not. But it was an early example of the kind of bogus race science that formed the basis of the Nazi obsession with Aryan superiority. Less than three decades later, Jewish skulls and other body parts would also be measured in these same ways to prove their supposed inferiority. The lines of connection between these two chapters in the bloody history of eugenics were direct. For instance, one of the most active experimenters and skull collectors in Southwest Africa was Dr. Eugene Fischer. His research focused on the supposed perils of race mixing for the colonists. Hitler read his research while in prison and cited it in Mein Kampf. Once the Nazis came to power, Fischer adopted his racial purity theories to the supposed threat of Jewish blood. He also joined the Nazi Party. He trained several SS doctors, including the so-called Angel of Death, Josef Mengele. Mengele was known for his gruesome experiments on twins in Auschwitz. As with the Nama and Herero, Jewish and Roma skulls and other parts were also preserved for German study. So this is not 6 degrees of separation between a genocide in Africa and a genocide in Europe. This is no degrees of separation. The Nazis also drew inspiration from further afield, including, as we've been learning more and more, from the bogus race science and racial apartheid that reigned in this country at the time that the Nazis were formulating their ideology. For their war on the disabled, they took inspiration from the U.S. eugenics movement, including state laws that mandated forced sterilization of those deemed of inferior genetic stock. This was the era of Jim Crow segregation laws, and Hitler got more pointers on how to strip German Jews of their citizenship by studying these laws. So much of this has been known in the academy, but it has started to reach mass audiences in recent years through books like James Whitman's Hitler's America Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, which came out in 2017. And this was further popularized in 2022 with Ken Burns's docu-series, The U.S. and the Holocaust, as well as Raoul Peck's series for HBO, Exterminate All the Brutes. This literature also explores the way the Nazis were shaped and influenced by the Western frontier in this country, the core precept of settler colonialism that saw colonists push ever westward to claim more territory for settlement, deploying a range of genocidal tactics to eliminate indigenous people from their lands. In the early 1900s, It had been the African colonies that played this settler colonial role for Germany. But when Germany lost those colonies in the First World War, they needed their Lebensraum, and so they came up with this idea that they could model an